From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the President and the Pontiff. Contentious views are exchanged as the two leaders meet for the first time.
I was grateful to have the opportunity to speak with him about the responsibilities that we all share to care for the least of these, the poor, the excluded.
Also today, the House and Senate vote overwhelmingly to approve a $1 billion aid package for Ukraine. Our reporter on the Hill has those details. And Egypt's army chief sheds his uniform to make a largely unchallenged run at the country's presidency.
Sisi has basically been almost begged by a large amount of people in the nation to run for the presidency. I'm not saying that that necessarily means the entire of Egypt is gunning for him to be president.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The United Nations General Assembly has approved a vote upholding Ukraine's territorial integrity and condemning Russia's actions in Ukraine. The vote, though, has no enforceable power and is therefore seen as largely symbolic. Nick Harper reports from the United Nations in New York.
An overwhelming majority of member states voted in favor of the draft resolution. It's the first time that the General Assembly has met to discuss the issue of Ukraine, and although it won't lead to any concrete action, it symbolically shows just how isolated Russia has become, as well as acting as a very public, historical record of what the member states think of Russia's actions.
Former Ukrainian Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko has announced she plans to run for the country's presidency in May. The former premier was released from prison in February, following 3 years in jail on corruption charges. Supporters of Ms. Tymoshenko say her charges were politically motivated. Meanwhile, the International Monetary Fund has pledged to provide up to $18 billion U.S. dollars in bailout loans to Ukraine over 2 years. However, officials say the country must do its part by taking tough measures to reform Ukraine's economy. Speaking at a joint news conference with Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi during a visit to Rome on Thursday, U.S. President Barack Obama called the IMF's decision a big step forward. The president also expressed his support for American financial aid, pointing towards a $1 billion assistance bill which was passed easily by the U.S. Congress on Thursday. Mr. Obama urged Ukraine's leaders to move towards reforms and leave past corruption behind.
And Ukraine's leaders can show considerable courage and foresight by making the reforms that will help them grow their economy, leave behind the corruption of the past. And today I want to call on the United States Congress to make sure that the United States does its part with an economic assistance package that helps support the Ukrainian people as they move forward.
While President Obama was in Rome, he also met with Pope Francis for the first time, which he called a great honor. The president has invited the Pope to visit the U.S. next year. Kate Fisher reports from Washington.
The Vatican says the Pope and President discussed issues including freedom of religion, immigration reform, and ending human trafficking.
I was extremely moved by his insights about the importance of us all having a moral perspective on world problems, not simply thinking in terms of our own narrow self-interests.
President Obama presented Pope Francis with a custom-made seed chest featuring a variety of fruit and vegetable seeds used in the White House's garden. The Pope gave the President a papal letter known as an encyclical, which President Obama said he would read in the Oval Office to calm him down when he got frustrated.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Around 90 people remain missing as search and rescue operations continue following the deadly mudslide in the U.S. state of Washington. The confirmed death toll has now risen to 25. Authorities say they expect the number of dead to increase as crews are having difficulty getting through the mud to recover bodies. Chinese President Xi Jinping is winding up a 3-day tour of France, where the two countries have been marking half a century of relations. A large business delegation is traveling with President Xi, and so far around $25 billion U.S. dollars worth of trade deals have been announced. As FSN's Ollie Barrett reports from Paris, France is keen to balance its trade deficit with the world's second largest economy.
French President François Hollande insists these are all significant deals, these are huge numbers, and that they will bring growth prospects and a more healthy employment rate for many years to come for France. Certainly, the French also feel that they can offer something to the Chinese as well. They believe that France is a perfect route into the European economy for Chinese companies.
And in the US, President Obama is announcing that he wants the US government out of the business of storing telecommunications data for intelligence purposes. The storage of telephone metadata by the National Security Agency was first revealed in documents from fugitive whistleblower Edward Snowden. Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff reports.
U.S. President Barack Obama has simply decided that the American government should not retain telecommunications metadata in bulk. Instead, he wants that information to remain with the telecommunications companies, and then the National Security Agency would need a court order to obtain that data pertaining to a specific phone number. Campaigners had protested the storing of vast amounts of information about which numbers made telephone calls and when, saying that violated Americans' privacy.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
I was extremely moved by his insights about the importance of us all having a moral perspective on world problems and not simply thinking in terms of our own narrow self-interests.
President Obama, following his hour-long meeting with Pope Francis in Rome Thursday. This was the first time the two leaders had met, an encounter Mr. Obama described as extremely moving. Speaking in the Italian capital, the president said he and the pontiff share common goals of improving the quality of life for millions around the world. The US leader gave Pope Francis fruit and vegetable seeds from the White House garden and in return received a copy of the Pope's manifesto published last year. For some details on the historic exchange between the two figures, I spoke to Rome-based journalist Josephine McKenna.
Well, President Barack Obama was very enthusiastic about his meeting with Pope Francis and immediately told him how much he admired him and thanked him for allowing him to visit him at the Vatican today. The city was in a total lockdown as 1,000 police were on the streets, and President Obama was traveling with around 200 agents as well. But the talks between the two leaders touched on controversial issues, including abortion and contraception. The president was accompanied by the US Secretary of State, John Kerry, and their delegation was led past a very colourful ceremonial Swiss guard inside the private area of the Vatican, down a richly frescoed hall. And through that room, he was escorted into a private room where he met the Pope. They shook hands warmly. There were big smiles. And he told Pope Francis he was a great admirer of the Pope. The Pope and the US President met for 50 minutes, and that seemed to establish a very solid rapport, and it seemed to go very well. But in a brief statement after their meeting, the Vatican said the talks touched on the rights to religious freedom, life, and conscientious objections, suggesting that they had expressed some concerns perhaps about abortion and contraception being made available under US healthcare laws.
Just ahead of Mr. Obama's meeting with the Pope, a Gallup poll was published on Wednesday which said that 76% of Americans view the pontiff favourably, and that's in comparison with 52% for President Obama. Do you think there's an element of Mr. Obama hoping that some of that papal stardust, that some of that papal magic rubs off on him, because it's been a stellar year for the Pope?
It has been a stellar year for the Pope, and you could say he's still enjoying something of a euphoric period. Very few people seem to criticise what he's done, and he's already introduced many changes at the Vatican, overhauling the Vatican Bank and putting in some dramatic changes inside the administration or the Curia. and making the Catholic Church much more financially accountable, while also stressing this message of compassion and concern for the poor. And it's this message where the two men really came together. President Obama later in the day spoke about how much he admired the Pope's compassion. And in the Vatican statement, the Vatican said that the two men had a mutual concern for the poor and a common commitment to eradicate human trafficking. So it's certainly clear that they had some crossover on some issues, but with the midterm elections looming in the US, it's perhaps not too far off target to speculate that this president was indeed looking for some of that popularity to rub off on him. And he's not the first political leader to show up at the Vatican looking for some of that, what did you call, stardust, from the Pope to rub off on him.
And shortly after the two men spoke, President Obama then moved on to meet with some of Italy's political elite.
Immediately after his meeting with the Pope, he went to meet Italian President Giorgio Napolitano and had lunch with him at the presidential palace, the Quirinale Palace, and then held a joint press conference with the new Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, who could barely contain his excitement, saying that Obama was a true inspiration to him and his newly appointed cabinet. And for Americans, it's perhaps a little unusual to grasp somebody like Matteo Renzi. He's only 39, he's a father of three children, and he has really modelled himself more than any other Italian leader on President Obama and the former Prime Minister of the UK, Tony Blair, by creating a modern, enthusiastic and positive political leader who is really about creating change in this country. And so to see those two men come together at the same press conference was really quite interesting. And as I said, Matteo Renzi could barely contain his excitement.
Josephine, can you tell us a bit about how the Italian public have reacted to this visit?
The economy here is in the doldrums. They're fighting their way out of recession. And I think Italians in general have a very low opinion of themselves. So to have a visit by President Obama has created a lot of interest and enthusiasm. And people here are saying, isn't it great that President Obama has noticed us? On the other hand, some are very critical because today, for example, the Colosseum and the Roman Forum, a very important source for tourism dollars, was completely shut down for a private visit by President Obama this evening. And the traffic has been disrupted all over the city. There's a red zone restricting people's movements in the centre of the city. So it's a very divisive visit, but overall I would have to say that most people are very enthusiastic about the attention.
Rome-based correspondent Josephine McKenna. This is FSN Reports.
We are continually hopeful that Russia walks through the door of diplomacy and works with all of us to try to resolve this issue in a peaceful way.
President Obama speaking alongside the Italian Prime Minister, emphasizing the unified response of the US and EU towards Russia's annexation of Crimea. As Mr. Obama spoke in Europe, here in the US, Congress passed bills to extend more than $1 billion in loans and aid to Ukraine, strengthen sanctions on Russian officials and companies, and fund US government news broadcasting in the region. The votes, which will send the legislation to President Obama in the coming days, followed on the heels of a deal between Ukraine and the International Monetary Fund. The tentative agreement would give the struggling country about $18 billion, but require the interim government to implement austerity reforms. Our Capitol Hill correspondent Alice Olstein reports.
Only a small handful of the hundreds of lawmakers on Capitol Hill voted no on legislation to loan money to the Ukraine and impose financial sanctions on Russia. One of them was California Republican Dana Rohrabacher.
Number one, thwarting anything that Putin and the Russian government is trying to do, wherever they're trying to do it, we consider it our job to thwart them, whatever it is, And if we continue treating them as in a hostile way, we're going to reignite the Cold War, and it will be a lot more costly than what these folks are calculating today.
But nearly every other lawmaker voted Thursday to pass the bill, which includes provisions authorizing about $1 billion in loan guarantees and $150 million in direct aid to Ukraine, and imposes sanctions against some Ukrainian and Russian officials, blocking their access to assets and banning them from travel to the U.S. The list includes some of Russian President Vladimir Putin's closest friends and government officials, and one major bank. After the bill sailed through the Senate on a 98-2 vote, Tennessee Republican Bob Corker said he hopes Congress will go even further in the coming weeks.
We're appearing a little bit cautious today. I do think if we could sanction three or four more additional banks in Russia, it would have a strong effect on their economy. I think, again, Putin needs to see that. I know we don't want to throw the whole toolkit, the whole kitchen sink at them today. Otherwise, they have nothing to lose by going ahead and going into Ukraine. But I do hope we'll turn the volume up to agree.
Additional legislation expected to pass by the end of this week would increase funding for the government-run Voice of America and Radio Free Europe news outlets to broadcast in Ukraine, Crimea, and the surrounding region. New York Democrat Elliot Engel said he thinks it's vitally important to get the U.S. government message to those divided populations.
Because right now they're hearing propaganda from Putin in Russian and not getting much other information, and we feel that if we can broadcast in Russian and get them the other side of the story, which we believe is the correct side of the story, that it would go a long, long way, and as during the Cold War, when it was very effective in getting the truth out to all these people who don't have the opportunity to learn the truth.
Several lawmakers, including Senate Foreign Relations Chair Robert Menendez, also praised the International Monetary Fund for tentatively agreeing today to lend about $18 billion to Ukraine, an announcement that followed weeks of negotiations and on-the-ground investigations.
My view of IMF is not only a financial institution, as President Reagan said, the linchpin to the international financial community, but also is a use of a security tool, because all of our concerns about the Ukraine will not be resolved if you can't financially stabilize the country.
But the money comes with many strings attached, and in order to receive it, the interim government has promised to freeze wages, cut pensions, partially or completely privatize several state-owned industries, and drastically increase the cost of home heating. The IMF said they expect the deal to be approved and finalized by the end of April. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
While Barack Obama continues to promote his message of Western unity against the actions of Russia, Ukrainian expats living in Moscow amid the growing tension over the crisis in their homeland are facing a different challenge. Our correspondent in the Russian capital, Natalie Feary, has the story.
Vladimir Rizun never thought that being Ukrainian in Moscow was a problem until now.
A couple times I heard some roots. It's never happened before.
As he makes his favourite tea from Crimea, a beverage he insists is still Ukrainian, he tells us how worried he has been about those back home in Kiev.
When you're in Moscow and you every day reading and news, watching TV, you can't even normal working, you can't normal sleep, you're always thinking about that.
But now he says he has even bigger concerns.
Russians, Ukrainian, everybody knows it. It's like our brothers. If you're far away from Ukraine and every day this guy from TV said like, these people hate you, these people hate you. And people start to think like, oh, they hate me, so I hate them.
An artificial hostility that he says is driven by the political rift between the two countries. But there are many ethnic Russians in Ukraine that feel the new interim government in Kiev does not represent them, after the parliament moved to repeal a bill allowing Russian to be used as an official language, despite around 30% of the population speaking Russian. The move was vetoed, but made many people nervous, including Vlada Cherbakova, an ethnic Russian who decided it was time to leave Ukraine.
I moved a couple of weeks to Moscow because it was very difficult for Russian people because the political situation.
And while Crimeans now automatically qualify for a Russian passport, Vlada will have to wait 3 to 5 years for citizenship. But she says it is worth the wait.
The level of life is higher than in Ukraine.
Vlada now plans to stay for good, but the same can't be said for Vladimir.
More and more I started thinking to go to Ukraine. You couldn't earn money like that, like in Moscow, but for living in Kyiv, more comfy.
Seeing his future now in Kyiv, Vladimir plans to move back within the next few months. Natalie Feary, Moscow.
Egypt's army chief has announced his resignation so he can run for president in upcoming elections. Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who led the military coup overthrowing the country's first democratically elected leader, Mohamed Morsi, last July, gave a national TV address to announce his plans to run for office. His decision comes amid reports one person was killed during protests against Monday's court verdict to sentence more than 500 alleged Muslim Brotherhood supporters to death. Correspondent Belle True is in the Egyptian capital and spoke to me earlier.
Sisi has basically been almost begged by a large amount of people in the nation to run for the presidency. He hadn't necessarily chosen to do so after he ousted Mohamed Morsi last July, but definitely there's been rallies on the streets, fierce campaigns in the media, and political figures, as well as sort of grassroots organizations calling for him to run. I'm not saying that necessarily means the entire of Egypt is gunning for him to be president, but certainly there has been extraordinary lionization of the now civilian but former field marshal in the last 8 months since he ousted Mohamed Morsi.
Can you give us an idea of what it's like for the opposition in Egypt and their chances of forming some sort of credible response to the overwhelming popularity of Sisi?
Well, there's only one other presidential contender who's called Hamdi Sabahi. Now, he ran in the 2012 presidential elections and was largely disregarded until he actually came third in quite a kind of surprise move. And, you know, clearly sort of got a lot of support from the kind of revolutionary groups that weren't keen to have a Muslim Brotherhood regime or a sort of old regime in the form of the of Ahmed Shafiq, who were the two people who were running in 2012. Now, Hamdi Sabahi has tried to position himself once again as the revolutionary candidate, the civilian option. He is a Nasserist, so that means he's a nationalist and a socialist. And so he's been pushing that in all his statements so far, talking about building a new Egypt, a fairer Egypt, where you can close the gap between the poorest who are getting poorer and the richer who are getting richer. But the problem is, of course, is that Hamdi Sabahi is going to be facing, the man who a lot of people here regard as the hero who saved Egypt from a kind of Islamic caliphate in the form of the Muslim Brotherhood presidency of Mohamed Morsi.
And Belle, what do you think the relationship will be if Sisi does take the presidency between Egypt and Washington? Because that relationship, that's been strained of late.
Well, everyone's discussing this because, of course, you know, relations have soured in the last 8 months between the military here in Egypt and Washington over the number of massacres and the sheer sort of human rights abuses that, you know, America has been watching with horror from afar. They have, of course, they did temporarily suspend some of this key economic assistance that America does give Egypt in the form of military aid and also just financial packets. But that was only temporary, and that is due to be put back in place. America does make a lot of statements saying they're concerned, particularly by a recent mass death penalty verdict, which happened just the day before Sisi announced his presidential bid. But in the end, Washington and America are very close. Washington's interest in the region is keeping it very stable, and the two main players for that are Egypt and Israel. Even, I think, you know, after a very bloody military coup that we've seen the last 8 months with 16,000 people arrested and over, I think, 3,000 people killed, America is still, you know, shaking hands with Sisi, picking up the phone and delivering economic aid. So I think, you know, it is in their interest to keep Egypt on side if you look at the bigger political problems in the region, particularly with areas like Syria blowing up. So I think, you know, America is probably quite wary of a military president, particularly the very military man who overthrew the last democratically elected one. But in the end, they need to have that pact with Egypt. They need to keep Egypt on their good side in order to have stability in the region. So whatever happens, I think they'll still keep close to Sisi.
Belle True in Cairo. Now, South African entrepreneurs have become increasingly high profile in Silicon Valley, the Californian mecca for technology-related startup companies. And now other South African business people hoping to build their own multi-billion dollar companies are also looking for a way in. From corporate law and immigration rules to networking and management styles, a move to Silicon Valley presents tough challenges for any new entrepreneur who must understand how the ecosystem works in order to succeed. That's where the diaspora can help. The Sable Accelerator is a consulting network of South African expatriates headquartered in the Valley. Its members want to give back to the South African economy and help nurture talent by using years of experience to mentor, train and fund their compatriots' fledgling businesses. Rebecca Bowring reports.
It's the early morning rush for lattes at one of San Francisco's famed roadside food trucks. South African entrepreneurs Andries Malan and Graham Pyle need a caffeine fix more than most. They're pouring all their energy into a new business. Sacrifices had to be made. Graham left his pregnant wife and child behind in South Africa.
It was an unpopular decision.
My wife was very, you know, supportive. She knows that this is something I've wanted to do for a long time.
Co-founder Andries sold his car to move operations to San Francisco and says it's hard to keep overheads low.
I'm spending roughly 10 times more on rent here than I would be back in South Africa.
The pair feel Silicon Valley's unique infrastructure, its access to capital, huge pool of developers and expert feedback make the gamble worthwhile. But they need connections and introductions. That's where Sable, the South African business link to experts, comes in.
Hey, how are you doing?
Well, and you? Good to see you again.
This consulting network of South African expats offers coaching and mentoring to help emerging growth companies in South Africa access markets abroad. It was started by Donovan Neil May, president of Global Fluency.
If we can connect those expats who have bountiful knowledge and connections and expertise with innovators in South Africa, I think we can make a lot of things happen.
From Tesla and SpaceX's Elon Musk to YouTube financier Roelof Botha, South African entrepreneurs have become increasingly influential in Silicon Valley. But a ride on the so-called tech superhighway can be a culture shock for new arrivals. Donovan Neil May again.
You know, they tend to be a little bit more reserved. Business is done a different way. You know, it's a much more old boy club-based approach. It's why they do well in the UK, and when they come to America, it's a very different ball game.
A ball game that some entrepreneurs, such as Barry Caton, get a kick out of playing. He's created Cognition, a software platform that helps sustain change management. He says he deeply appreciates the risk-averse approach he finds in the US.
The wonderful thing about America is this openness to new ideas and the ability to experiment and say, let's try this thing.
As well as offering one-on-one advice, Sable also hosts gatherings where expats can cozy up over imported South African wine and Boerewors sausages. They also give entrepreneurs visibility and a forum to pitch their products.
$1 billion fund behind you.
More than half of all Silicon Valley businesses were co-founded by immigrants, including major names like eBay, Google and Yahoo. The Sable Accelerator aims to propel the brightest and best South African talent to success and to turn a brain drain into a brain gain by encouraging those who make it to go back to South Africa, set up businesses and reinvest in the economy. Rebecca Bowring, Silicon Valley.
And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can always email us reports@featurestory.com, and you can follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Friday, a special edition of FSN Reports. Simon Marks talks with Steve Sestanovich, author of a new book that says foreign policy in America is caught between presidents who want to do more and those who want to do less. That's tomorrow's special edition of FSN Reports. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Kate Fisher and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.